I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Angela Crocker joins me again. The author has just written a new book, Digital Life Skills for Youth, a guide for parents, guardians, and educators. As teens and even those younger are finding themselves inevitably online, the need for digital skills is important. There are all sorts of risks nowadays that the young are particularly vulnerable to, whether it's cyberbullying, identity theft, or request for nudity. It's impossible to keep tabs, so endowing young people with digital savvy is key. That's where this book is particularly useful. I'll ask Angela about what parents ought to do, whether limits or staying offline altogether is particularly possible or practical. I'll get Angela to reflect on some of the concerns arising from an increasingly digital world, what trends she's noticing, and just how the discourse online has evolved or devolved in recent years. Angela Crocker is an author, speaker, and instructor who helps individuals and business navigate the issues, challenges, and joys of living a digital life. She's often candid about her own experience as an educator, as a mother, and as a citizen online. She holds a Master of Education degree from Simon Fraser University and is on the faculty of the British Columbia Institute of Technology. She is the author of previous books, The Content Planner and Declutter Your Data, and was co-author of Digital Legacy Plan. Her website is at angelacrocker.com. This new book is published by Self Counsel Press. We spoke in late October. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Angela Crocker. Ms. Crocker, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So the expectations on young people today are a lot different than when you and me were growing up. Young people today are exposed to, say, digital devices and the sort at an earlier age. I guess we as adults, we haven't really thought about that in a way that, I mean, there are obviously dangers, but there are practical things that we need, and this is why your book is so useful, because it makes us look at what needs to be done, right?
Absolutely. The dangers are often talked about. They're big, scary headlines about cyberbullying and requests for nude photographs and all sorts of things. But the vast majority of young people actually need more help with the practical day-to-day things. And they need skills to deal with the scary things if they should happen, but they also need skills to manage their calendars, to understand effective communication, to manage their online reputations, and dozens of other activities as well.
The slur that I hear a lot is that because of digital devices and the sort, young people don't know how to communicate as well as they should compared to, say, when you and me were growing up. Is that something that you're finding?
I'm finding quite the opposite. I think that they're very good communicators. However, they're communicating in a different way than you and I did growing up. They are spending less time face-to-face and more time interacting through devices, which in and of itself is not a bad thing, as long as they're making meaningful connections with real people.
That's what you say in the book, and you give a marvelous guide at the end of the book of the lingo and how adults, parents especially, should know what these various symbols or these acronyms are, not only to relate to the children in their lives, the young people in their lives, but to actually know what's going on, right?
Yes, it's often surprising when I talk with adults, particularly parents of youth, you know, in this age where I'm talking about people 11 to 15, 18 years old.
Yeah.
There is all these secondary meanings to certain emojis that they're using to communicate, and often conversations happen exclusively in emojis. And they may legitimately be using an emoji for its intended definition, but sometimes the intention is something that is a secondary meaning that is theoretically subverting parents' understandings. And it can be very disconcerting for parents when they realize that a message may not be as innocent as it appears at first glance.
Right, right. There's also the case of where parents are often ill-equipped or unable, say, because of language and the sort, to comprehend all of this. That places the onus on educators. Do you find that educators, or teachers especially, that there are challenges for them in terms of, say, I mean, they're the ones who have to, say, teach the kids this stuff because their parents can't?
Yes. In fact, the inspiration for this book came about while I was doing a Master's of Education degree at Simon Fraser University and talking with the people in my cohort who were working with young people in the middle school and high school systems. You know, there was so much expectation on digital citizenship curriculum and digital skills that they would learn at school. However, there are still skills that they should be learning at home. And it's not as clearly defined as potty training is something parents teach at home, yeah, and algebra is something teachers teach at school. There's a huge amount of crossover and gray area, and the teacher's digital skill as well as the parent's digital skill, they may not have the skills themselves to be able to pass them on. And so with the book, what I'm trying to do is sort of spark that conversation, identify the skills that youth need, and help both parents and educators to foster these young people coming up, not only in terms of good digital citizenship, but in terms of digital skills that are going to help them have a happy, productive, creative online life, as they are going to have. We've let this genie out of the bottle. There is no putting the internet back on the shelf as something we're not going to use. So let's help them figure out how to use it in healthy ways, creative ways, productive ways.
Now, there are different parenting approaches. I mean, you can have a parent that allows some use of devices and the sort, some that have none at all, and then, you know, there's some that say, you know, it's a free-for-all, if you will, in some households. The one where there's none at all, is that possible nowadays?
Well, I think it's possible for parents to say no screens and not provide their children with access to computers or mobile phones or tablets or any of those sorts of devices. But the reality is out and about in the world, they are going to see screens. They are going to run across things, and they're going to need to be able to use them in order to complete their schoolwork. Many schools are providing on cloud-based word processing and other programs that they're using to create their assignments for school, to do their tests, to watch the videos that are part of the lesson. So in the book, I do acknowledge the parents that have made that decision to completely restrict. I also acknowledge the parents that allow what I call a digital free-for-all, where they're not monitoring in any way. Uh-huh. But the majority of parents fall in the middle somewhere, and I've very consciously written this book and done this research to try and allow for families to have autonomy, to choose how they want to use this technology. But my hope is that they are going to, along the way, at some age, they're going to allow their children to learn these skills, because when they go out into the adult world, just like learning that alcohol has side effects, technology has side effects as well, and you don't want your young adult to have their first exposure when they are out at university or beyond the family control.
Absolutely, yeah. Is there a consensus in terms of the ideal screen time, say, per age group, maybe?
Well, that was one of the most interesting bits of research I did. There is very much a lot of research that says a certain number of hours is appropriate for certain ages. However, when I got digging into that research, it's very hard to compare. The age of the child is not the only factor. We have to take into account their maturity, their ability to self-regulate, their other health conditions, their needs. And so rather than prescribe a certain number of hours per day per youth based on their age, what I recommend instead is a framework of self-care and wellness and social connection. And so it's things like, are they looking after their personal hygiene, having a shower daily, brushing their teeth? Are they making meaningful social connections with friends and family? Are they keeping up with their schoolwork? And a big one is, are they getting enough sleep? Teenagers, it varies by study once again, but, 8 or 9, 10 hours a night is certainly an appropriate amount of sleep for anyone in that middle school, high school years. So my approach is, if all of those healthy factors are in play, then whatever time's left over could potentially be screen time. And that screen time also needs to look at the quality of the screen time.
Right.
If they're just mindlessly watching whatever the next suggested video is on YouTube without any thought, perhaps that's not the best use. But if they're actively looking on YouTube for ways to solve problems, or they're researching politics, or they're wanting to build something, or they want to rebuild the motor of a drone that they've been given for Christmas and then something's gone wrong, these are great uses of technology that are allowing them to really exercise their research skills, their critical thinking skills, and giving them tasks to do that are physical things that they need to fix. It's very exciting what's possible when the screen time has that kind of quality to it.
Really, the key to all of this, I'm not a parent, but I guess the role that adults can play is communication and talking about this and figuring out, you know, as you said a moment ago, what their needs are, what their maturity level is. And I guess a great way which your publisher focuses on these contracts, and this is a great way of putting it in writing as to what's expected and what's allowed, if you will.
Yes, I have a number of different contracts in the book that are intended to be adapted for each family or each school classroom. There's a version for teachers and a version for parents. And I've done this with my own son. He has had an internet use contract updated every year since he was 4 years old, where we started talking with him about, you know, that strangers are online and not revealing personal information. He's now a teenager himself, and that contract has evolved to allow more freedom online and different privileges, of course, you know, as he grows into social media and online communities in his own right that are not monitored in the same way that we would have when he was very small.
Yeah.
I like these kind of contracts because they give parents and youth a common framework. They come to an agreement where they've cut the terms and conditions, if you will, you know, rather than just checking the box on the terms and conditions, they actually have a conversation about what things are important to them as a family, what behaviors are acceptable, and they're written down. It creates this common place where they can come back and they can reference it if they need to, they can update it if they need to, and it will, like any contract, it can evolve over time.
Indeed, indeed. The other thing that evolves over time is privacy. I would assume that a child, if you will, would I mean, privacy is not a big deal, you know, if you're four. But I think as you grow up, as you're a teenager, I think you would expect more. And so, how much should a parent, say, be responsible in terms of giving? How much privacy is a young person, say, entitled to?
Well, it's an interesting question because the privacy, you know, when they're very small, we do tend to post more baby pictures and young children pictures as parents. By the time children are 8, 10, 11, they start to have an opinion about their online reputation and may want certain pictures posted or not. They may aspire to be internet famous, which is an exciting prospect. But then when they get to the older teenage years, in general, youth are looking for more control over their digital footprint and their reputation, and that privacy piece becomes important. And so it's awkward because parents, you know, being a parent, that's your story as a parent. Mm-hmm. However, the child is part of that story, and so respecting their privacy is key. So it's this juggling balance between, you know, what is the parent's story to share, what is the youth's story, and certainly ensuring that the parents don't exploit the story and ensuring that the youth don't give up their privacy in such a way that might damage their ability to get jobs in the future. Or if they have got something out there that maybe is a little bit, you know, maybe they shouldn't have, hopefully it's a youthful indiscretion. You know, you and I, Joe, we grew up in a time where we all had little things that we did that are not documented on the Internet.
Uh-huh.
So I would love to see, and I certainly advocate for us fostering a culture where the missteps that youth make along the way, the mistakes that they make, can be forgiven, even if they do live on the Internet.
Yeah.
So figuring out that privacy piece is so essential for every family.
What about from the young person's perspective, say, the ability of the parent to monitor who they talk to, what they're actually saying online? Does that that obviously changes as they get older, doesn't it? I mean, at a certain point, a parent, I guess, do they stop when they're, let's say, grade 12, monitoring what their kid is doing online, say?
Not necessarily. I talked to many, many, many parents as I was doing this research, and I talked to some parents that had young people in their families who were in their 20s who were still having their communications monitored. I also talked to parents who had children as young as 9 or 10 who were not monitoring their communications at all. I think that over the years from elementary school through high school until you reach adulthood, my hope is that we are fostering digital life skills in youth so that they can take over their own communication and be responsible for it and not need that monitoring. Mm-hmm. But again, it's going to vary on the maturity, the ability, the privilege that each youth has. And it's just like screen time, privacy is not necessarily age-based in terms of parental monitoring.
Right.
They're going to have to build trust, and if they break the trust, then maybe that monitoring is going to continue for a longer period of time. It's going to be different for every youth.
And who pays for this stuff? I mean, a lot of kids are getting jobs and the sort, so they would think that they're if they have the money on their own to buy whatever they want or that they're entitled to use it as they wish. I guess one can build that into a contract as well in terms of say the monthly fee, if you will, or the price of data, as well as mm-hmm. the price of the device itself.
Yes, youth are getting jobs to pay for these things themselves. And there are a lot of parents that are providing the technology and paying the monthly fees as part of a family plan of some sort.
Yeah.
I personally don't think that parents should abdicate their responsibility as parents simply because a youth can afford to buy their own mobile phone and pay for a data package. The privilege of using that technology is a privilege, and even if they've paid for it themselves, I do think that parents and teachers have a role in helping them learn to use it in healthy, creative, productive ways. There'll probably be some pushback from the youth around that. My money, my choices.
Right.
But similarly, they can go out and they can buy other things that are potentially harmful, and that's not okay. As parents, we would intervene. So my hope is that parents would not use the money argument solely as a reason to provide or not provide technology. Let youth have a say in it, but they've got to follow certain rules. And whether it's outlined in a contract, that's a written contract, as I recommend in the book, or that's more of a verbal understanding amongst family members, either is fine. Again, there's a range of things that families can do, and every family is going to take a different approach. And as long as there's some approach being taken, we can hopefully navigate this whole thing around the money that is technology.
The theme throughout your book, not just this book, but previous books that we've talked about over the years, has been this idea, and it's not just in this case in digital life skills for youth. It's fostering it at a young age, but it's this idea of digital citizenship that we have responsibilities as to how to comport ourselves online in the world itself, and there is acceptable behavior for all of us, and I think that's what's needed, especially when you think of how much bad there is out there.
Yes, and I think that the rules are so variable because we don't have these conversations, and I guess all of my books have this sort of running theme, as you say, around how we comport ourselves online, and that responsibility, if we use it well, it can serve us well. If we are using it poorly or we are infringing on the social norms of our online community, and everyone's community is different. One person might belong to a community where, cursing is very acceptable. If that's the case, that is the cultural norm. But another community might be horrified that there's so much cursing in communications online. Whatever that communication process is, it's just one aspect of how we're living online. We have to respect other people's privacy. We need to manage reputation. We need to be aware of bias in the news, be aware of sources and references and providing source material citation type stuff. There is so much that goes into being a digital citizen, and we're really all learning at this point. Online world is about, for the masses, maybe 15 years old,
a
generous estimate. In some ways, it too is a youth still figuring it out and growing up.
Right. How do you talk to young people about, because you're an educator as well, and a parent, because you have people in authority who are trolling, who are bullying online and the sort, and there's this dark side to it all online.
Yes.
How do you explain to people that that's not how to lead, say, a productive life online?
Well, I think being aware of those issues before they happen can help youth and adults, for that matter, to have some familiarity with what are bullying behaviors, for example, so that they can be identified early on before the bullying gets too severe. Unfortunately, severe incidents do happen. And at that point, there is important that youth especially reach out to trusted adults who can provide some guidance and, you know, help them get out of the argument if it's simply an argument, or help them seek, you know, assistance from the police or even take legal action if it's required. I'm always optimistic that we can find a way to find the best in us so that those issues are not as prevalent. And I think that the volume of reporting of those sorts of incidents gives them more weight in the public's minds.
Yeah.
I don't have the citation handy, but there was a study I looked at that was suggesting that something like 97% of youth will never be asked for a nude photograph. 3% will, and that means, you know, tens of thousands of children in North America. But the 97% that aren't, you know, can we continue to protect them by talking to them about the possibility, you know, if that request for a nude photograph comes through, what do they do? How do they say no? How do they report it? If they don't know what to do when it comes about, they might be tempted to send a new photograph, and that creates a whole new level of problems. It's an ongoing learning curve for everybody, and I'm really hoping to open up that dialogue and sort of change what we're talking about. Although it's important to acknowledge the dangerous things, I think it's even more important that we talk about the everyday things and that we empower youth to be aware of the difficult, dangerous things, but that they know what to do to get help before it becomes a huge problem.
But do you find, Angela, that you're rolling a rock up a hill trying to teach good digital citizenship, but then you have a president who tweets these nasty things online and gets away with it, if you will?
Certainly, the behavior of sort of politicians and other public figures is terrible. One of the systems that we can use as more reasonable adults is modeling better behavior. And youth are heavily influenced by not only the adults around them, but by their peers. I'm actually doing some work right now with a middle school in the Lower Mainland who is these students are going to be working with me to work out, you know, how are we going to create a culture of modeling from a peer networking kind of approach. And I'm calling it Skills Squad. And it's more so for the youth to have a grassroots movement where they can advocate for these best behaviors and really present themselves as models for other teens, hopefully to counteract some of this negativity that they're seeing. And you know, if they're mostly influenced by their peers, which is what the research suggests, then that peer networking, hopefully, is work that I can help facilitate and will grow over time to reach more and more teens.
Do you get that, though, the young people saying to you, hey, Angela, if the president uses that word, why can't I?
I don't get that. I'm not sure that the president is on their radar in that same way.
I see.
I don't know that they're seeing that information. They're more likely to see information from their peers or from public figures that share their interests in a different way.
Celebrities, for example. Yeah.
Celebrities, you know, in music and sports and other, you know, activities, a wide variety of interests that young people have, of course.
Yeah.
But it's a question I will now be, you know, keep an ear out to see if they are looking to people like President Trump, so to see what they are reading and hearing.
Yeah. There's a part in the book that I found incredibly useful because it's something that I contend with all the time, and that's remembering these damn passwords that we have everything for. And, you know, I used to be someone who used the same one for everything, but obviously that's not safe. What advice would you give us in terms of how to manage all these different passwords that we need to come up with, that we have to maintain, that we have to remember, that we can't?
Passwords is a great example of a digital life skill that we're all having to master. I have a number of different strategies. Different things work for different people, keeping track of them. Some people are still using a notebook and a pencil. I don't recommend that, but it's better than nothing.
Yeah.
Others are digitizing that and using a password-protected spreadsheet or word processing document to record them. And there are services available where you can have one master password that you do have to remember, but then that software unlocks all of your passwords and creates very complex, difficult to crack passwords. Services like Dashlane, 1Password, those kinds of services provide that. There is some pushback. People are leery of those kinds of services sometimes because they don't necessarily trust in them. They do have excellent reputations. But any of these strategies will help people manage their passwords. And the sort of the bigger picture advice, it's another digital life skill that I recommend, is really being conscious about what accounts we open online.
Mm.
The more accounts you have, the more passwords you need that are unique, the more you need to keep track of. My earlier book, Declutter Your Data, I talk extensively about how we can have an online life, but we could be conscious about how we sign up for things. And maybe we don't need that special shopping account, or maybe we don't need another gaming account, and therefore there is one less password to remember.
Yeah, and changing passwords regularly, is that something that you practice, eh?
It is something I practice as best I can. I am fallible, as anyone. As much as I know that is the ideal advice, certainly there will be periods of time where I let my password stay stagnant, probably for more months than they should. Ideally, I believe the current recommendation is to change them every 3 months.
Yeah.
But if you have a couple of hundred accounts, that's a lot of changing to do. And so, again, these services that have the master password, they will take care of that for you.
Yeah.
But changing them is important, and even just protecting them. Being mindful is another digital life skill to use. Being mindful when you do certain things on open internet network and the internet cafe or on a college campus, your data is more vulnerable than if you are using a protected network, say in your home or at school, where there is some security measures at the network level that protects your use of the internet in a slightly different way.
I guess my three favorite words on a web page or whatever I'm trying to log into is forget your password with a question mark. Clicking that, and I guess in a way, if I'm changing it regularly, I'm doing my part, if you will.
You are, absolutely.
It's nice to talk again, Angela. Congratulations on this book, and good luck with it.
I appreciate that, Joe. Thanks so much for having me back.
The website for more is at angelacrocker.com. The book is called Digital Life Skills for Youth, A Guide for Parents, Guardians, and Educators. It's from Self Counsel Press. Angela Crocker joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.